The couple of suttas from the Kanda Samyutta this evening again. The first one is number 87, and it's entitled Wakali. That's the name of the monk, Wakali. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. Now on that occasion, the Venerable Wakali was dwelling in a potter's shed, sick, afflicted, gravely ill. Then the Venerable Wakali addressed his attendants. Come, friends, approach the Blessed One, pay homage to him in my name, with your head at his feet, and say, Venerable Sir, the Bhikkhu Wakali is sick, afflicted, gravely ill. He pays homage to the Blessed One with his head at his feet. Then say, it would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Blessed One would approach the Bhikkhu Wakali out of compassion. Yes, friend, those bhikkhus replied, and they approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and delivered their message. The Blessed One consented by silence. Then the Blessed One dressed, and taking bowl and robe, approached the Venerable Wakali. The Venerable Wakali saw the Blessed One coming in the distance, and stirred on his bed. The Blessed One said to him, Enough, Wakali, do not stir on your bed. There are these seats ready. I will sit down there. The Blessed One then sat down on the appointed seat and said to the Venerable Wakali, I hope you are bearing up, Wakali. I hope you are getting better. I hope that your painful feelings are subsiding and not increasing, and that their subsiding, not their increase, is to be discerned. Venerable Sir, I am not bearing up. I am not getting better. Strong painful feelings are increasing in me, not subsiding, and their increase, not their subsiding, is to be discerned. I hope then, Wakali, that you are not troubled by remorse and regret. Indeed, Venerable Sir, I have quite a lot of remorse and regret. I hope, Wakali, that you have nothing for which to reproach yourself in regard to virtue. I have nothing, Venerable Sir, for which to reproach myself in regard to virtue. Then, Wakali, if you have nothing for which to reproach yourself in regard to virtue, why are you troubled by remorse and regret? For a long time, Venerable Sir, I have wanted to come see the Blessed One, but I haven't been fit enough to do so. Enough, Wakali, why do you want to see this foul body? One who sees the Dhamma sees me. One who sees me sees the Dhamma. For in seeing the Dhamma, Wakali, one sees me, and in seeing me, one sees the Dhamma. What do you think, Wakali? Is form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself? No, Venerable Sir. Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Are volitions permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Venerable Sir. And he continues through the same series as in the Anattalakkhana Sutta to the end. Seeing thus, he understands there is no more for this state of being. Then the Blessed One, having given this exhortation to the Venerable Wakali, rose from his seat and departed for Mount Vulture Peak. Then, not long after the Blessed One had left, the Venerable Wakali addressed his attendants thus, Come, friends, lift me up on this bed and carry me to the black rock on the Isigili slope. How can one like me think of dying among the houses? Yes, friend, the bhikkhus replied, and having lifted up the Venerable Wakali on the bed, they carried him to the black rock on the Isigili slope. Then the Blessed One spent the rest of that day and night on Mount Vulture Peak. Then, when the night was well advanced, two devatas of stunning beauty approached the Blessed One, illuminating the whole of Mount Vulture Peak. Standing to one side, one devata said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, the Bhikkhu Vakali is intent on deliverance." The other devata said, "Surely, Venerable Sir, he will be liberated as one well liberated." This is what those devatas said. Having said this, they paid homage to the Blessed One, and keeping him on their right, they disappeared right there. Then when the night had passed, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Come, bhikkhus, approach the Bhikkhu Vakali and say to him, 'Friend Vakali, listen to the word of the Blessed One and two devatas.' Last night, when the night was well advanced, two devatas of stunning beauty approached the Blessed One. One devata said to the Blessed One, 'Venerable Sir, the Bhikkhu Vakali is intent on deliverance.' The other devata said, 'Surely, Venerable Sir, he will be liberated as one well liberated.' Then the Blessed One says to you, 'Friend Vakali, do not be afraid, Vakali. Do not be afraid. Your death will not be a bad one. Your demise will not be a bad one.' 'Yes, Venerable Sir,' those bhikkhus replied, and they approached the Venerable Vakali and said to him, 'Friend Vakali, listen to the word of the Blessed One and two deities.' Then the Venerable Vakali addressed his attendants, 'Come, friends, lower me from the bed. How can one like me think of listening to the Blessed One's teaching while seated on a high seat?' 'Yes, friend,' those bhikkhus replied, and they lowered the Venerable Vakali from the bed. Last night, friend, two deities of stunning beauty approached the Blessed One. One devata said to the Blessed One, 'Venerable Sir, the Bhikkhu Vakali is intent on deliverance.' The other devata said, 'Surely, Venerable Sir, he will be liberated as one well liberated.' And the Blessed One says to you, 'Friend Vakali, do not be afraid, Vakali, do not be afraid. Your death will not be a bad one. Your demise will not be a bad one.' Well then, friends, pay homage to the Blessed One in my name, with your head at his feet, and say, 'Venerable Sir, the Bhikkhu Vakali is sick, afflicted, gravely ill.' He pays homage to the Blessed One with his head at his feet. Then say, 'Form is impermanent. I have no perplexity about this, Venerable Sir. I do not doubt that whatever is impermanent is suffering. I do not doubt that in regard to what is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, I have no more desire, lust, or affection. Feeling is impermanent. Perception is impermanent. Volitional formations are impermanent. Consciousness is impermanent. I have no perplexity about this, Venerable Sir. I do not doubt that whatever is impermanent is suffering. I do not doubt that in regard to what is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, I have no more desire, lust, or affection.' 'Yes, friend,' those bhikkhus replied, and then they departed. Then, not long after those bhikkhus had left, the Venerable Vakali used the knife. Then those bhikkhus approached the Blessed One and delivered their message. The Blessed One then addressed the bhikkhus thus, 'Come, bhikkhus, let us go to the black rock on the Isagili slope, where the clansman Vakali has used the knife.' 'Yes, Venerable Sir,' those bhikkhus replied. Then the Blessed One, together with a number of bhikkhus, went to the black rock on the Isagili slope. The Blessed One saw in the distance the Venerable Vakali lying on the bed with his shoulder turned. Now on that occasion, a cloud of smoke, a swirl of darkness, was moving to the east, then to the west, to the north, to the south, upwards, downwards, into the intermediate quarters. The Blessed One then addressed the bhikkhus thus, 'Do you see, bhikkhus, that cloud of smoke, that swirl of darkness moving to the east, then to the west, to the north, to the south, upwards, downwards, into the intermediate quarters?' 'Yes, Venerable Sir.' 'That, bhikkhus, is Mara, the evil one, searching for the consciousness of the clansman Vakali, wondering, where now has the consciousness of the clansman Vakali been established? However, bhikkhus, with consciousness unestablished, the clansman Vakali has attained final nibbana.'" So that is Vakali's story. And I just I think it's a nice rendition of somebody who used that immense physical suffering that he was going through, piercing, racking pain, as a way of impelling him. You know, he was impelled towards insight and liberation by the pain and difficulty he was going through. He really was able to see suffering and contemplate the five khandhas as being totally unsatisfactory. And through that insight, even on his deathbed, was able to attain full liberation. And then I guess it also brings up sometimes the often talked about controversy is you know, the implication that committing suicide, which is, you know, generally regarded as producing negative karma. But there are several stories in the canon about arahants taking their life. And the Buddha basically says that if an arahant takes his own life, then essentially that's blameless. There's no karmic consequence in regard to that, because the bhikkhu, the monk, the arahant, is free from that kind of karmic effect.
Then there was a spirit rock teacher who told me once that he thought the Buddha did that by ingesting the mushrooms or whatever it was, the poisonous that were given to him. And I didn't. I think my answer was like, well, I don't know whether that's true or not. But anyway, he was not. He didn't have any negative effect on him.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty speculative, kind of a.
It was a speculative one. That was his interpretation, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's not. There's not a basis for that I'm aware of. But.
It's also worth noting that Bhakti's immense respect for the Buddha and Nama. He's suffered all that, and he's, you know, and she says, well, you know, get me out of this potter shed. I'm going to die outside where it's more harmful.
Right.
And then get me down from my bed. I can't listen to the blessed one's words.
Yes.
While I'm lying on this bed.
Yeah, yeah, I think that is very notable. He was also, I think, the one who was known for the foremost in faith. I remember reading that, foremost in faith, for the Tathagata, the teaching. Yeah, there's actually the commentary makes note of that same point, that it's a very beautiful image of him wanting to show respect no matter how much pain and suffering he was in.
Are there any other teachings or stories about the significance, if any, other than his personal preference to be, to die outside or to be outside?
Well, I think that it was the way that the footnote goes was is that he got to the shed by because he was on route from one place to another, and then he fell gravely ill. So this shed was kind of a quick immediate shelter. Let me see if I can find that. Oh, yeah, here we go. After completing the rain's residence, the elder was on his way to see the Blessed One when he fell ill in the middle of the city. He could not walk, so they put him on a stretcher and carried him to a potter's shed. So I think my sense was is that, you know, rather than it necessarily being that he wanted to be, you know, essentially out in the open, he just didn't want to be in kind of a householder situation. He wanted to be, you know, in a bit more of a, you know, natural setting, you know, with his fellow monks. That was my impression. I've not heard anything about place to die, you know, being in the outside is being preferable to any other place. I've heard that one, Paul?
No, I just think, yeah, just sort of being in a place that's a bit more reminiscent of someone's life.
It's interesting, one of the other footnotes says that another one of the few accounts of a monk taking his life was the same place, the Isigili slope, the black rock of the Isigili slope.
Did Ajahn Mun have to be taken to like that? He was en route somewhere.
Ajahn Mun?
He was en route somewhere, I thought, and he was asked.
No, he was at a monastery. He asked them to take him to Watsutat. He was at a small village, a fairly small village, quite rural, and he was concerned, knowing full well that when he died, there was going to be a huge gathering, and that would be really tax the villagers and create a lot of logistical problems, so that he had them taken to Watsutat, which is a Dongyut monastery in those days on the edge of Sokornakon, which is a provincial center, so had a large market and had the resources to look after a large number of monks. Very practical.
Okay, go on to the.
I was very appreciative of Ajahn Chah dying in the middle of January. If you'd have died in the rainy season, it would have been very difficult. Already in the hot season. But it was kind of perfect timing for the ground is dry and then there's still quite a bit of water in the ground. So, in terms of well water, supplying people.
Okay, we'll move on to the next one. This is Anuradha, number 86. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Vaisali in the great wood in the hall with the peaked roof. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Anuradha was dwelling in a forest hut not far from the Blessed One. Then a number of wanderers of other sects approached the Venerable Anuradha and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, they sat down to one side and said to him, "Friend Anuradha, when a Tathagata is describing a Tathagata, the highest type of person, the supreme person, the attainer of the supreme attainment, he describes him in terms of these four cases. The Tathagata exists after death, or the Tathagata does not exist after death, or the Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death, or the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death." This is apparently a classic Indian, what they call the tetralemma. When this was said, the Venerable Anuradha said to those wanderers, "Friends, when a Tathagata is describing a Tathagata, the highest type of person, the supreme person, the attainer of the supreme attainment, he describes him apart from these four cases. The Tathagata exists after death, or the Tathagata does not exist after death, or the Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death, or the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death." When this was said, those wanderers said to Venerable Anuradha, "This bhikkhu must be newly ordained, not long gone forth. Or, if he is an elder, he must be an incompetent fool." Then those wanderers of other sects, having denigrated Venerable Anuradha with the terms "newly ordained" and "fool," rose from their seats and departed. Then, not long after those wanderers had left, it occurred to the Venerable Anuradha, "If those wanderers of other sects should question me further, how should I answer if I am to state what has been said by the Blessed One and not misrepresent him with what is contrary to fact? And how should I explain in accordance with the Dhamma so that no reasonable consequence of my assertion would give ground for criticism?" Then the Venerable Anuradha approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and reported to the Blessed One everything that had happened, asking, If those wanderers of other sects should question me further, how should I answer so that no reasonable consequence of my assertion would give ground for criticism? And the Buddha replies, what do you think, Anuradha? Is form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, venerable sir. Then goes through the full sequence of the Anattalakkhana Sutta questioning, and concludes with the end phrase, therefore seeing thus he understands there is no more for this state of being. Then he goes on further. What do you think, Anuradha? Do you regard form as the Tathagata? No, venerable sir. Do you regard feeling as the Tathagata? No, venerable sir. Do you regard perception as the Tathagata? No, venerable sir. Do you regard volitional formations, consciousness, as the Tathagata? No, venerable sir. What do you think, Anuradha? Do you regard the Tathagata as in form? No, venerable sir. Do you regard the Tathagata as apart from form? No, venerable sir. Do you regard the Tathagata as in feeling, as apart from feeling, as in perception, as apart from perception, as in volitional formations, as apart from volitional formations, as in consciousness, as apart from consciousness? No, venerable sir. What do you think, Anuradha? Do you regard form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness taken together as the Tathagata? No, venerable sir. What do you think, Anuradha? Do you regard the Tathagata as one who is without form, without feeling, without perception, without volitional formations, without consciousness? No, venerable sir. But, Anuradha, when the Tathagata is not apprehended by you as real and actual here in this very life, is it fitting for you to declare, friends, when a Tathagata is describing a Tathagata, the highest type of person, the supreme person, the attainer of the supreme attainment, he describes him apart from these four cases, the four of the Tetralemma. No, venerable sir. Good, good, Anuradha. Formerly Anuradha and also now, I make known just suffering and the cessation of suffering. So this is, I think, a classic presentation of the question about the apprehendability of the Tathagata at death. It comes up in a few other places in the canon as well. But it just, you know, really points out the underlying kind of misconception or misperception that the Tathagata, just by, you know, by the questions, the way these questions are asked, or the way these four descriptions in the Tetralemma are worded, it makes an assumption right from the very beginning that is not a correct assumption. It's assuming that there is some sort of inherent being, essentially, in the Tathagata in this very life. So rather than trying to establish what happens after death, the Buddha basically tries to establish the questioners in tries to establish them in right view, that by going through the, you know, all the possible ways that a person could conceive of some inherent everlasting essence that is an enlightened being before their death. And obviously, you know, he goes through the whole sequence of the five khandhas and trying to establish whether the Tathagata is one of them, all of them, none of them. And the answer is no, all through the whole sequence. So so then it renders the whole speculation of what happens after death as kind of a moot point. So if you can't establish any particular kind of substantial, unchanging entity or soul or anything like that in this very life, then it's pointless to try and speculate about what happens after death. And then serves as a an emphasis too, that, you know, the Buddha basically is not trying to teach any kind of metaphysical treatise about what happens after death, particularly to an enlightened being, that his teaching essentially is a strategic teaching to point out the Four Noble Truths, the truth of unsatisfactoriness, suffering, and that there is a way out, a cessation, and a path leading to that. It's emphasizing that very strongly. Any thoughts? So are the bhikkhu satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words? And everybody else too? Right.
And then I guess there are a confusion of them. So someone who isn't present to the stream would be, you know, just grasping would be the way in terms of those khandhas that they would answer. I mean, because you wouldn't say that to answer those questions then and say this is how Pratujana is would apply to those questions. Or someone who's not an arahant. You know, because you say what a Pratujana, you know, fill in the blanks with that question, with the four questions.
Would
instead of saying does an enlightened person exist after death?
Oh, I say
Pratujana exists after death. Then it would be good grasping.
Same thing. Totally and completely same thing.
Because the khandhas are just treated.
Whether an enlightened person is identified with the khandhas or an unenlightened person, yeah. It's still identification with the khandhas.
But it's interesting, I don't know if it comes up with something. What happens to the institution after that?
Well, it depends on what wrong view.
Buddha does address that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Go ahead.
No, mm-hmm. It's just as good as that. There's a sutta where it's speaking of the kind of the impulsion of and the Buddha makes it, you know, it's like karma pushing him on to rebirth, and the Buddha says it's like a flame that's blown by the Buddha. So there's a force that pushes the flame. Normally the flame goes up and pushes up.
And the Pratujana could have any of the same wrong views about themselves as, you know, one that would have about an arahant, you know, an eternalist view or an annihilationist view or a half and half view or the fourth one, which is, you know, just not answering the question. Mm-hmm.